So, welcome to episode 30 in the Management to Zero podcast. There's another episode in English. I'm sitting here with Professor Eric Sui in Potsdam. He gave a talk on knowledge management yesterday on the Knowledge Camp. So, welcome, Eric.
Thank you, Simon.
I asked you to join the podcast because I want to talk a little bit about your perspective on knowledge management, your experiences. And since you came from Asia and work in Asia and in Australia and join conferences there and so on, to let the European guys here give a little information about what games like in Asia and what the trends are that you see at the moment. But first of all, let's talk a little bit about you and how you came into the field of knowledge management. I saw on your LinkedIn profile, you did your bachelor in Sydney on computer science. Like one can say you're an IT or technology guy by education, and did your master in the University of Southern Queensland at the beginning of the 90s. So how comes that you're in knowledge management today? Tell us a little bit about your history.
Well, thank you. In fact, the order, you know, it's material. I first did my bachelor degree at the University of Sydney, and you're right, I graduated with a computer science specialty. But after that, in fact, I didn't go directly to University of Queensland. There's something in between, and that's a doctoral degree, PhD degree at Deakin University in Victoria, also in Australia. And I did a PhD research degree in artificial intelligence and knowledge engineering. You know, at that time, there's nothing called knowledge management. It was just called, just like today, artificial intelligence, expert systems, and so forth. Looking back, I can consider that to be some kind of micro KM, because we are always, figuring out how to represent a sentence, figure out how to represent words, so that machines can not only can store and retrieve, but be able to do some manipulation, comparison, or what we call reasoning. Yep. Now, then after that, I did the MBA degree. But at that time, the reason why I did the MBA degree is exit from Deakin University after 1 year postdoc fellow. I started working for a large company called Computer Sciences Corporation, which now is being rebranded as DXT Technologies as a part of HPE. Anyway, I worked for nearly 10 years in the Expert Systems Group, drawing on my knowledge on AI and expert systems. And I soon realized that, we can't solve many of the world's problems purely just by technical knowledge.
Yeah.
So I find that, look, I better, beef up my knowledge on area of business. So I pursue an MBA. So that's the sequence. Bachelor, and then PhD, and then go back to do a master in MBA.
And the discipline of knowledge engineering, is it like how to extract knowledge from human brains and transfer it to machines and let them decide and reason?
Yes, that's a core part. And knowledge engineering is about how to elicit knowledge from, at that time we called domain experts, right? And we don't have the classification of tacit versus explicit. And as a knowledge engineer, we would have to identify what to elicit, how to elicit, and after we have elicited, how to actually represent it in a structure that can be stored, retrieved, and as I said, compare, manipulated, reasoned by computers.
And it's doing interviews with experts? And
there are many methods. There are many methods similar to what we're doing now in process management and reverse engineering. You can let the domain expert roam free and think aloud and talk about what they are thinking when they are doing. That's one method. Another one is, as you said, interviewed, interrogation by a guided structure of questions. And then you have to go back to see, hey, what if this doesn't happen? What if you take this path, then what happened? Try to map out the rest of the reasoning paths. You can also reverse engineer some of that knowledge from enterprise systems, because business rules have already been, some business rules have already been encoded into the system. It's been operational. And when you ask people, sometimes people don't know, because, the people who set the rules have already left. You're only left with systems or left with code.
They embodied in the system. So
that's also a kind of corporate asset. So there was also work involved in locating the right system, locating the right chunk of code, and then reverse engineer from there. And typically at that time was Fortran, COBOL, and sometimes even go down to assembler-like level of code in order to extract or reveal those kind of codified knowledge. So a combination of those typically represent the knowledge elicitation work for knowledge engineers.
Right. And after 10 years at this company, you joined university, or is there anything between?
Again, it's not as a simple crossover like that. And even during the 10 years, in fact, I worked for Computer Sciences Corporation for 16 years. First 10 years was on expert systems, and then the other 5 or 6 years was on innovation and knowledge management. All along, throughout the period of employment in industry, I have had one foot in academia. So, I've been, visiting lecture, teaching part-time, teaching regularly courses, AI expert systems at various universities in Australia for 10, 15 years. And in fact, it was during those time that there came an opportunity from a professor who asked me to start preparing and delivering a course on knowledge management.
And this is what you're doing nowadays, like the Master of Science in Knowledge Management?
Well, eventually, because of my interest and passion, it worked out that way, but originally it was from University of Technology in Sydney that they asked me just to prepare a subject on KM systems, and that was around about 1997, and with the launch in 1998. And I recall that it was very interesting because I got a call from the late Professor John Debenham, and he's a good friend and my good mentor, and I was working at CSC as an expert systems consultant. And then he called me one day and said that, Eric, our department has decided to launch a course on knowledge management systems, and we want you to deliver it. And then, with all respect, I listened carefully. And then I asked him, knowledge management? I don't know anything about it. And the response was so enlightening and inspirational, and I'll never forget it in my life. The answer was, my boy, this is exactly the reason why we want you to go and deliver it.
All right.
I didn't understand what that means. It was something the logic seemed all wrong, but I came to realize that if you don't know anything, throw yourself into the deep end, and you have to learn everything about it in order to be confident and be able to share.
And this is the bridge between dealing with expert systems in the artificial intelligence domain and the shift over to knowledge management systems.
Well, it's not that much difficulty for me to accommodate because, as you can appreciate, firstly, at that time when I start to learn about KM, I have already worked in the industry for about 10 years, right? And then secondly, also assisted by the book knowledge and the practice knowledge that I've gained from the MBA degree. So I do realize that, KM is more like the macroscopic end of,
right,
of knowledge, right? So technology is one thing. And if whatever you develop, whatever you've done, and not be embraced by people, not being adopted by people, eventually it's a failure, right?
Yeah, right.
So, I didn't recall there was any major hurdle for me to evolve my knowledge and learning into the KM area at that time.
How would you define knowledge management and the knowledge management system?
Ah, that's a difficult question because I don't think the world has a universal definition for knowledge management. I would consider that to be a concerted effort to source, handle knowledge with particular, the emphasis on creating a cozy and natural environment for people to share and learn. The earlier days in KM, we focus on the processes, and we now realize that, in fact, knowledge is not a rigid, tangible thing with four corners where you can carve it and store it away. So the newer breed of thinking led us to think that, while we cannot, carve up knowledge, at least we can try to provide an environment so that various parties are feeling comfortable, natural, and easy to share. And then the latest that we know now is about in this environment, we have to tolerate, contradiction, complexity, and various types of opinions as well, and so it may, because that's precisely the elements that can breed innovation.
So when you use the term knowledge management system, it includes computers and content and data and human beings as well.
Precisely. In fact, to me, KM system is a socio-technical system that involves processes, technical elements, and these elements may or may not be fully integrated, right? But it's chained together with appropriate processes, with human input and interventions in a coordinated fashion.
Okay, so nowadays you told me you live most of your time in Hong Kong, also teach there, traveling around the world. The other time you're living in Sydney, Australia, I think. It's like this. It's like, where do you spend your life?
Well, it's more like working in Hong Kong at the Hong Kong Polytechnic University, business trips with conferences and duty visits around the world whenever the work and the university assigns me. Whenever possible, either my personal initiative or there is a business opportunity, found time to return to my Sydney home, for business and sometimes a bit of relaxation. And this year is especially special. I've never had so many invitations for me to visit Sydney for conferences and also talks at university. I have about 4 to 5 invitations to go back to my hometown, which is good.
You have this master degree on knowledge management you run in Hong Kong, I think out of the Department of Industrial and Systems Engineering.
That is correct, in the Faculty of Engineering, and that is the first and remains the only fully KM developed or fully developed degree entirely on knowledge management in Hong Kong.
And it's for like professionals already? It's like 1 year full-time or 2 years part-time?
Well, at our university we call this the mixed mode. In other words, we accommodate both students who have working experience. They will do it part-time, and we also take on full-time students who want to finish it in a year or, to 18 months.
And mixed mode means it's also like a blended learning approach. It's like physical lectures and also webinars and things like that, or how do...
They are correct. Mixed mode means it's full-time and part-time students. Blended learning is also our mode of delivery. So yes, the program activities are being delivered via a combination of things. We have, of course, the face-to-face activities. That's workshops, tutorials, seminars, and so forth. And that takes up, overall speaking, about 60% of all the activities. Then we also have online internet live lectures. And next Monday, I will be giving one, broadcasting from my office. Plus, we also have developed animations, games, simulations, online content for students to self-paced to go through. Plus, I also have configured a personal learning environment for each and every one of my students, so that even after they graduate, they still have this kind of collaboration and co-learning with everybody, including myself. So
great.
A combination of these things constitute our total learning environment.
And what does the curriculum look like?
It's a good question. The earlier research indicated that among the world's 2,000 or so KM programs, there are a number of major focuses among this program. There is the IT technology, the focus, which obviously they will spend more time talking about developing intelligent agents and some kind of another types of automatic measures to handle knowledge, including artificial intelligence and big data. Second type, it's a degree on KM that focuses more on library science, and those degree would have a stronger emphasis on categorization, classification, taxonomy, and so forth, and information retrieval, right? And then the third type is, primarily started by human resources departments and universities. They focus more on the cultural and organizational learning side. And ours has been judged by prior research that we are multidisciplinary, and ours are the only program in the world to actually produce KM practitioners.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a stronger emphasis on the practice end.
So the goal of the people taking part is to become a knowledge management responsible or chief knowledge officer in an organization?
Well, that's part of the goals. Of course, not everybody will make it with that career path. I have advised my students and graduates that what you learn from the program, you don't have to wait for an opportunity. You can create an opportunity by yourself in your own role, because many of the techniques that we cover in the program also applies to personal knowledge management. So start from yourself, start from your team, and gradually you will become a knowledge center in the organization. Start from there, in addition to responding to opportunities.
Like a role model in the organization that everybody wants to be similar to?
I hope so, and I imagine that is already happening. And if I look at the statistics of KM posts in Hong Kong, I would say that confidently, 70 to 80% of the KM officers entry positions in companies are fielded by our graduates.
Another thing I read about is that you're organizing sort of an Asian version of the Most Admired Knowledge Enterprise Award, which I think is a global award run by Teleos.
That is correct.
You organize a ceremony where all the Asian companies that took part gather and you give them the award. Or how does this thing work?
Well, it's more than that. Firstly, it's not me, it's our center, Knowledge Management and Innovation Research Center. And for the last, about 9 to 10 years, we have been doing that for the whole of Hong Kong. And for the last 6 or 7 years, we have also expanded to cover the whole of China as well. We do not just host the award ceremony. In fact, we pretty much do end-to-end. So we call for application. We give information sessions, helping people to clarify what needs to be answered in the application form. We invite judges, two rounds of judges, to review and assess the submissions. We hold the ceremony for the award. And then based on the Telia's guidelines, we conform to them and pass the results to Telia's every year.
And if you pick one or two examples of companies who won the award, like what were they doing? What were their approach?
Well, in Hong Kong, be it as it may, it turns out that many of the companies who are heavily into KM, they are large organizations. They're really huge organizations. If I focus on two, one is, for example, China Light and Power, which powers three quarters of the electricity needs in Hong Kong. So they have a KM journey for 10 to 12 years, very extensive. They did a lot of work on, for example, developing portals, e-learning materials, knowledge cafes, after-action reviews, and many other the techniques are being routinely used. They have a KM program in place and with KM officers in various responsibilities. I have been lucky in participating or even delivering seminars to them, and I find that they have no short of very enthusiastic employees supporting the KM journey. CLP, as a result, has been for a number of years and a number of times, being a recipient of the MAKE Award, at least at the Hong Kong level, but I think they may have got more awards. The other one that I like to quote is, I'm a personal advisor to them, is the Hong Kong Police in the government side. And again, Hong Kong Police, it's a or endeavors to be a knowledge-based force, right? Rather than just being seen as a paramilitary force. And it's amazing. It's truly a knowledge-based business for them because they share a lot about just about all the activities they do, about patrolling, about crowd control, about policing, about law, about use of ammunitions and arresting. All the things that they have done, they have KM measures to help sharing to a wider audience. They have also developed appropriate technologies to support even right to the mobile vehicle level. They have peer assist systems that when any of the officers on the road needs expert advice on specialist topics, they'd be able to refer a specialist and be able to contact this person for immediate expert opinion. So that's wonderful. And the Hong Kong Police also, spend a lot of work. It's now, in fact, I know that they are now spreading the KM gospel right down to the operational level, not just in the training school, but start to implement it and permeate that into, the line operations, into the local cells, and also into Marine and Auxiliary Police as well. There we go. We see an organization who are truly successful in KM, and is permeating the whole spirit of sharing knowledge across the entire organization.
And I think that there are some publications that we can link in the show notes of the podcast if someone's interested in these cases.
Yeah, I will do my best to find somewhere, and I can contact the Hong Kong Police for such information. Yes, I believe there are.
Cool. Let's talk a little bit about KM in Asia in general. So from your perspective, what are the major influencers, communities, and events there?
Events, communities. Well, let me talk about maybe communities first. In Asia, I'm led to believe that, most of the countries have already set up their KM society or KM association and are active.
Nationwide,
yes. And for a start, for example, in Hong Kong, we have the KMIRC. That is by our center. And there's also, you know, the Hong Kong KM Society. Both are active, and in fact, on many occasions, we join forces to host events. The last one was as recent as about 3 weeks ago. And I also involve, or KMS, KM Society, is also part of the KMGN, Knowledge Management Global Network, which I believe has linked up, for example, Italian, American, French, Thai, Japan, Hong Kong, Singapore, and several others, national KM societies as well. And we have a monthly Tenacon. And whenever any one of the member association has an event, we, you know, we together help to broadcast it and promote it to all the members worldwide in the alliance. And free passes are also given to other parties to come to attend.
To join it.
Yeah, so it's a good thing. And a few months ago, we have also started on a rotation basis webinars so that different topics are being covered from different groups. I gave the first one last year, I think.
Okay, so this is in terms of communities, like events. Do you have yearly conferences where one have to go or
yeah, in Asia, at least closer to where I operate. In Hong Kong, we have, as I said, the Hong Kong KMS conference. And in the last 2 years, I think the ARC Group has been running KM Asia in Hong Kong. This coming Saturday, I'll be chairing a Knowledge Information and Cultural Services Conference, KICS, I think, in Hong Kong. And then, you know, the KMIRC also hosts the IKMAP, Innovation Knowledge Management Asia Pacific Conference. But that's not necessarily in Hong Kong. That's on a rotation basis in Asia Pacific. Sometimes they come to Hong Kong, but not every time.
Okay, if you look at these conferences, you told me you were on the ECKM last week as well. What do you see in terms of trends and topics that are coming up in KM? What's new?
What's new? It's you know, I think you know, the people, slowly we're getting to see more and more research on the social media analysis, right? Which I thought is interesting. And hopefully the new advancement in artificial intelligence techniques and big data can help to make those analysis and predictions more accurate, right? And I'm starting to see more case studies being coming through and published in the area of financial services, in utility, and several other industries as well. So they're good signs, but they're sporadic. I wouldn't say that there's even advancement across all fronts.
It's like the combination of social media and big data analytics?
Not so much social media and big data together, but separate, yes, there are publications in this area.
So other trends you see?
In Asia or in Europe?
Globally.
Globally? Well, not sure if you agree. I actually feel that communities are coming back in a big way. You know, some people will refer to communities as in the second era, and that is right, because that is when we realize knowledge is not a tangible object, and knowledge resides in the head of people. And communities are coming back in a big way, but this time they are not just the people-to-people physical communities, and not just the virtual communities, but also communities that are set up by, for example, commercial organizations, NGOs, to cultivate support. So I call these, you know, affinity groups or advocacy groups. So these are also communities, and these communities require totally different facilitation and moderation skills, because these people are probably all online. They may not have met each other. Trust building is a big issue. And then with commercial organizations behind it, then there may be, you know, also various objectives to balance, so should I say. So therefore, I think there are new challenges. And these communities may be merging as well. For example, I've seen communities that evolve from COI to COP. I've seen communities that evolve the other way, from COP to COI. I've seen communities only form because of the eruption of a political issue, and after that it's all disbanded.
It's like, right? An ad hoc community or so.
Yeah, in Hong Kong in particular, communities has been a big thing. You know, through none of my influence, I've been giving talks on communities far more regularly than the last 5 years recently. And many companies like CLP, MTR, the Hong Kong railway transportation giant, they have, and the police, they have set up dozens of communities.
Do you see, I think I see a shift here in Europe and Germany from dealing with existing knowledge, transferring existing knowledge towards creating new knowledge, like innovation, topics like design thinking, human-centered design, things like that. Do you see this globally as well?
Well, I see this in our own work. I can't comment whether this is globally happening. In my own in our own research center, several of our students, research students, are actually applying design thinking to KM, and we have published some of this work, and we will continue. So yes, design thinking and the topic that I spoke on yesterday, KM and digitalization, right? These are all evolving new topics that came out in the discipline.
So last topic I want to cover, like 1 or 2 years ago, you started on edX, the MOOC, Knowledge Management and Big Data in Business. How is the process of creating such a MOOC? Did you ask edX or did edX ask you, like, how was the video recording and so on?
It goes back to a few years ago when our previous chair of the university council, and she was a graduate of MIT, and she obviously maintained good terms with MIT, and she is a strong advocate for blended learning, e-learning, and universal education through technologies. So she somehow cemented the relationship for us to be a part of the edX members. So probably you 3 years ago have already become a member of edX. Part of the responsibility of being admitted as a member is we have to put courses. We don't just put the university logo there, you have to put courses there. So I was unfortunately being picked up to develop the first one. I think probably because I have been employed at PolyU for 12, 15 years. And ever since day one at PolyU, I have been in charge of cyber learning, right? So probably they've seen some of my work in developing e-learning degree programs. So therefore, they asked me to go. And it's also my passion to develop a topic on knowledge management. So that's how it started. I got some funding from the university. And in a matter of about 12 to 15 months, with help from several other professors as well, including Professor Klaus Totterman from University of Kiel.
From Kiel, yeah.
Yes, and Professor Jay Lee from the University of Cincinnati, and Dr. Usama Fayyad, and he's ex-senior vice president and chief data officer of Yahoo, and is now managing director of Barclays Bank, I think. So these are top people in the field. And they help us to develop some content in their respective area.
And the curriculum was new or was it part of the master program?
Well, the curriculum has its roots in the master program, but obviously many of the topics are also specially added and designed because there's no comparison. The master program has about 12 to 15 subjects, and the MOOC at most can only be equated to a third of a subject. So somehow we need to condense some of the things that we want to cover in the master program into the MOOC subject.
And then you created the content on site in Hong Kong and then transferred it to the MIT and they put it on the platform, or how does that work?
Well, again, it's a combination. Most of the videos were recorded in Hong Kong in our university studio. Now we have three studios. And then sometimes on an ad hoc basis, we also go out to company website, a company sites, with their permission to do local recording, and we've done that in China as well. Plus, more recently, we have also mastered the skills of using our technology, but I'll just send a few lines of instruction plus a link to our invitees, and as long as they've got a good mic and a high-density camera, they can use our system to record, and we have the video.
Very nice. Okay, so in MOOCs, often people say that you have a high dropout rate, like a lot of people are registering but not doing the final test or exam or whatever. How happy are you with your MOOC? Like, how many people enrolled and how many people finished the MOOC?
Well, I think it's satisfactory, and we are now in this fifth delivery for that subject. And the current delivery just started about 2 months ago and will go until January of next year. And I just checked yesterday. I think we are edging towards 6,000 enrollments. Altogether, we have about, counting from first delivery, we have about 56,000 people who have registered. And approximately 2,000 people have completed it. Now, the completion rate is not it's not very high, and that's normal for MOOCs. And I'm led to believe that, in fact, we should not assume that people are here to complete the course whenever they sign up for the MOOC. And MIT research actually reveals that there are people who sign up for the MOOC because they want to know more about the topic APC. So once they watch one or two videos, if they think that they've got enough about what they need to know about APC, they will not continue anymore. There's also about a third of the people who join a MOOC. They are serious about that topic. And once they find out, hey, this is really what I want to learn more, they actually stop from continuing that MOOC. And interestingly, they start to look at the local universities to see whether those courses are being offered. And we have that effect because since we launched our MOOC, I've picked up about 10% of my new entry students who told me that they've completed the MOOC.
Oh, that's a very good thing.
So that's an unexpected effort in pulling in new students.
And you said you're in the fifth iteration, like you did twice a year, or how often is it run?
Yeah, we aim to run it twice a year. In the past, we run it about three or four times a year. Good news came from MIT 2 months ago. They told us that our course is one of the most popular and the most demanded course on their website. And they would request PolyU to run it more frequently and with extended period. So they suggest 6 months. And I that's how we plan. So we plan to run it for 6 months plus 6 months.
So we can put the link to the course in the show notes and listeners of the podcast can enroll there.
Yes. Well, I have already planned it for this. For 6 months, within the 6 months, we don't add new content into the MIT MOOC. But many of the learners, I've already collected them in a Google Plus community. So this will go into the Google Plus community. And then when it comes in January 2018 comes, when we upgrade our MOOC to the sixth delivery, it will be included in the sixth delivery.
Very good. So we put the link there and hopefully people join.
Yes, and last night the Knowledge Camp is already in the Knowledge Camp link replay is already in the Google Plus community.
Okay, Eric. So thank you very much that you took the time for joining me in the podcast.
Thank you, Simon. It's a wonderful opportunity. I hope everything is successful here.
Perfect. Thanks.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.